Welcome to Safety First with Danger Tate.
Welcome to Safety First with Danger Tate. I'm Tate, and this is my interview series where I talk to cool people about the cool things that they do. Our guest today is the co-founder of the pioneering raft company, Echo River Trips. He started the company in 1972, and by 1981, Echo was running 19 stretches of river in 5 states and Yugoslavia. So kind of a big deal. Our guest today is none other than Joe Daly. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I'm glad you're here, and I'm so grateful that you took time out of your life to come and chat. Where are you calling from?
I live in Berkeley, California.
Berkeley. Okay, great. How close is that to the American?
It takes maybe an hour and a half to get there, so it's pretty handy.
Yeah. Do you still get out often?
Well, I'm retired now, so
winning.
Not the way I used to. Not as many river days, as they
say. When you do get on the river now, what kind of craft are you in?
A raft. I never got into kayaking because I went immediately to rafting and got so involved with that part of it that I never took time out to learn the kayak skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, every kayaker needs a rafter, and every rafter, it's nice to have a kayaker. So way to fulfill the symbiotic relationship.
Right.
Well, Joe, you started Echo River Trips with a guy named Dick Linford.
Right.
Can you just give a little context into where the idea for Echo came from?
Yes. Part of it had to do with the era. I mean, as you said, we started in 72. And it was a time when the environment was a big deal. I mean, you had the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in 1968 was passed by Congress. You had the EPA formed in 72. You had the mood of the nation was focused toward the environment. So Dick and I were teaching in a public high school in the Bay Area. And in the summer of 70, I thought, okay, school year's over. I'm going to Europe. Got my backpack. Away I go. And so I had a great summer of going your rail pass, going all over Western Europe. I come back and say, what a great summer. And Dick goes, yeah, that's great, but you got to try rafting. River running's the thing. Mm-hmm. And he had worked for Lou Elliott, who was one of the founders of boating in general in California. Lou Elliott and Bryce Whitmore were the two who really, really got commercial rafting started.
So
Dick had worked a year for Lou. The next summer, Dick and I both worked for Lou Elliott. And at the end of that summer, we looked at each other and said, maybe we can do a business. And so that was the spring of 72 we started. And it really was the early days. It wasn't the very, very beginning of rafting, but we were probably the seventh or eighth company to form in California.
Wow. And what had you been teaching in high school?
Well, I've been social sciences. I taught sociology. I taught American government, history, a whole bunch of things. Dick taught English, psychology, and our rooms were right next to each other. And so we got to know each other gradually over the first year that we were teaching together. And we were compatible. It was just one of those lucky, serendipitous moments where the personalities were enough different that we didn't step on each other's toes, but we were compatible in so many ways in terms of how we viewed finance and other things. So it was a new territory to be starting a company because we didn't have any business background. We'd gone straight from college to teaching.
In the duo, what do you think like your strengths were that you brought?
Well, the compatibility gradually, it wasn't announced at day one, this is what it's going to be. So many things were kind of oozed toward conclusions. And mine turned out to be marketing and running the office. Uh-huh. And Dick's strengths were equipment, personnel. He's a charismatic person. Mm-hmm. And so, and then we had a lot of overlap too. So we blended well. And mm-hmm. and when I say it was new, I mean, there was no playbook to follow yeah. because we were so new at it. And you did what you had to do to get the raft on the water.
Were there moments of, why did we start this? We should be like, let's go back to teaching.
I think that topic came up with my wife's mind in 1977.
What makes you say that?
Well, in 1977, it was a classic, the deepest drought in California history was in 1970. In fact, I walked across the Stanislaus River, stone to stone, from one river left to river right, and never got my feet wet. The river was that low.
What's it typically, or what, like what? Yeah, what's the normal flow?
Oh well, it varies. You know, 1,000 CFS to 10,000 CFS.
Yeah, you know? Wait, not you should not be able to walk stone to stone.
Oh no way, no way. But and so at the end of that season, I think my wife was saying, you know, what's next? but that winter it rained, and so in 1978 we had a good year and mm-hmm. we went on from there. I mean, it was definitely a tough time because mm-hmm. You're burning the candle at both ends when you were teaching and running the rafting company, especially in the springtime.
Right. Well, yeah. So you kept teaching while you were still running Echo, right? For a bit?
The first 5 years. The first 5 years of Echo, and that's when the candle was burning on both ends. but then we just realized that this could be viable. This could be a business. This could be a way of making a living. And I have to say, it's a terrific lifestyle. There's just no doubt about it. A lot of hard work, especially in the springtime and the summer. In the early summer, that you have long days, 7 days a week. But it balances out. So,
what was it like with your wife? Was she all in and like super excited? You said 1977 wasn't as much, but did she enjoy the river? Does she?
Well, she does enjoy the river, but one of the amazing things is that she's in the theater world. So she's into the arts. And so I joke with my River Bunny fans when I say, well, I'm going off to get some culture. So I've been cultured for 53 years.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. That's awesome.
So it's an interesting balance in terms of our being together. So I enjoy the art world and she enjoys river running. Again, both of us are retired now.
Right.
So we don't go out as much as we used to.
What's the best part of retirement?
I would say the lack of day-to-day tension.
What do you mean by that?
Well, with river running, you're always on alert. And during the river season, you have to be ready for everything. The phone could ring, a truck could break down, a crew has some problems with getting to a location. So you're always ready. As one outfitter used to say, you're always ready for the other shoe to drop. And in that sense, it was always good to have the quote, the off season. You know, when the river running season was over, you had a chance to kind of catch your breath and get caught up and remake friendships that got lost. I got lost during the river season.
Well, with Echo being so big and being across so many different states, what was your day to day? Were you in California or did you travel around a lot?
I moved around a lot.
And did you?
Basically, yes, we were in California, but it was good that we had the partnership because Dick could be in the Rogue area. I could be in Idaho and mm-hmm. we both could be in the Sierra foothills. Mm-hmm. And so there was mobility. We definitely had a lot of river days. We knew what we were getting into. It's seasonal. And so you work real hard during the season.
Yeah. With your background in teaching and like being involved and knowing what's going on with the government, you mentioned that, you know, the environment was really on everybody's mind when you started it. How did having the rafting company play into public policy and like advocating for public lands?
Well, that came about gradually. In other words, we started the river company, and then we realized certain rivers were being threatened and that we had to step up and speak about policy. It wasn't initially on our mind. And I think also the teaching background did help, you know, being able to speak in front of a group. Mm-hmm. That was pretty easy for both of us. And I mean, not easy, but you could do it. and we just realized that there's a political side to everything. And you have to recognize that you've got to protect the rivers. And we were involved in lots of river battles. And the Stanislaus, we lost that river, but the Tuolumne battle was historic, and we won that one. I mean, the odds of winning that when that campaign started, you were against the city of San Francisco. You had irrigation districts; they had tons and tons of money, and we should have just been defeated. But we had a very good executive director. The outfitters were all in terms of saving the river, same with the environmental group. And there was a real blending of many forces that made that happen.
That's so cool to be a part of that. Have you, you've stayed involved, right, with the Tuolumne, what is it, the Tuolumne Land Trust, or what's it called?
It's called Tuolumne River Trust.
River Trust.
I am still involved. I was one original board member, and then I was president for 12 years or something like that.
Wow.
But now I'm on the advisory board. So
okay, great.
That means you get to step back. You don't have to go to every meeting, but you can still throw your voice in there once in a while.
Yeah. What's the project that the Tuolumne River Trust is working on now?
Well, it's surprising. It's range. There was a massive fire in the Sierra probably 11, 12 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And so there's a huge restoration program going on. I mean, many, many acres of restoration. Mm-hmm. They're involved in that. They're also, the Tuolumne River ends up going through the city of Modesto, which is about 120, 130,000 people.
Wow.
And there's a park system that's being developed there, and the Tuolumne Trust is involved in the restoration or the creation of that park system.
Oh, cool. I mean,
it's going to go on for miles.
Will it be similar to like on the Rogue, it goes through Grants Pass, and so there's a lot of like access points through that. Is it that kind of a thing?
Yes, it is. The difference is that you have more agriculture around the Modesto area than you do right around Grants Pass per se.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
With all of your traveling around, did you have a favorite river? And when you started Echo to like running it, were you getting on and guiding for the trips? Or
oh yeah, I mean
really?
One of the reasons we changed the nature of our company is that we weren't getting river days. When we started out, we got to one point where we were running 19 rivers, and it was just driving us crazy. We were in the office the whole time, and Dick and I looked at each other and said, this is not what we planned. we went river time.
Yeah.
And so we scaled back, and we cut back, and on the rivers that we'd only like run once, one or two trips a year, we said, well, forget that. And so we ended up running a solid half a dozen rivers that really, really gave us, you know, 20, 30, even some years more river days. And
amazing.
And that was a good balance.
Was it a scary change to go, okay, yeah, we have all of these like different rivers, all these different sets of income coming in, and then scaling back so much?
It wasn't. It was less pressure. Imagine logistically that you're packing up to send a group to Alaska, but you're also running two crews in Idaho. You're running two crews in Oregon. You're running at least three or four crews in Idaho. There's one trip in Utah, and you got to the point where you were just in the office all the time doing this, doing that. And you said, this is not what we want as a lifestyle. And so having the half a dozen rivers gave us a good lifestyle living. It was much, much better balanced.
What kind of boats were you running?
All sorts of rafts. We'd have paddle boats, we'd have oar boats, we'd have the combination, we'd have inflatable kayaks.
Did it start with bucket boats?
Oh, it sure did. Oh.
Would you have to have the guests? Would you have to have the guests bail the boats, or were the guides doing it?
No, the guests, absolutely. The
Awesome.
guests. I mean, we exhausted more guests with 5 gallon buckets. If they didn't think they were going to get a workout, they got it because they were knee deep in water.
Oh my gosh.
And so there was the early days was definitely bucket boats, and it changed the game when the self-bailing boats came. I mean, that was
Who?
almost like going from the propeller of the airplane to the jet.
Yeah, literally. Who were the clientele, at the beginning?
Oh, quite a range. Initially, it was pretty a macho setting. I mean,
Okay.
in the early days. I mean, not
Yeah.
the guides were all male. Mo many of the guests were male because it was the, in there was the that's the thing you do. You go out on the weekend and you be a man, you know. And then gradually, over time, we realized that it's probably better for the crew to be mixed, have women and men. And then the public began to catch up. I mean, we used to have in the first days of having women on the cruise, we would have men walk down to the boats from the bus. They get out of the bus, they walk down the boats, and they walk right by the women and say, "Where's the guide? Where's the guide?" And we're going, and the woman goes, "I am the guide." And they were going like,
What was that like? Did that cause tension on the cruise, or were those problems that you had to solve, or how did you back up the women to like?
Having the women on the cruise was actually an improvement. Meaning, when in the macho days of the all got, the men, they want to be stronger than the other guy. They want to do something more than the other guy. They want to skip a stone farther than the other. I mean, they're very competitive and not very cool about it, not very smart about it. And so
Yeah.
we'd have really unnecessary tensions among the men. And the women were a leveling influence. And I mean, they could just simply say, "Boy, that was stupid." And the men would pause and think about it and go, "Yeah, I guess maybe it was stupid." So it improved things actually to have the balanced cruise. And with that, also the community, the public was changing. And they were continuing that outdoor spirit of camping and doing things. And we gradually began to have more mixed groups, and to the point where a majority, vast majority of the trips are families.
It has kind of become like a magical place for families to connect.
No doubt.
What's interesting to me now, though, is it seems like most families want to come on a river trip. Most parents want to bring their teenage kids on a river trip so that there's no cell service. But when you started, there were no really cell phones to worry about. So
No.
how has that been to watch that dynamic change on the river? Have you noticed any major changes from the beginning of Echo to before you retired?
Well, the cell phone was, and satellite phones, both were a bit of a problem. For the teenagers, the cell phone was, it was like a stressed out, we can't connect. And we're going, "Yeah, you can't connect." So let's say on a 6 day salmon, Middle Fork of the Salmon trip, they were grumpy the first day or so, and but by the second day, certainly by the third day, they were into the trip, and they just kind of forgot about their phones.
Yeah,
The
I've noticed that on the road the last few years too. It's the same thing. The first day, everyone's a little angsty.
And for the bigger challenge was businessmen, in particular, not so much business women, but businessmen. They were almost demanded having a satellite phone,
Interesting.
and that became a challenge. And so we had to set parameters, and mostly we said no, but every once in a while we had to say, "You have to go away from camp. You have got to go downstream, and you cannot be obvious. I mean, this is a vacation for everybody. You can't be selfish about doing the business on a vacation." And for the most part, that worked.
When you were guiding, were you always the trip leader, or were you ever just a guide or JAG, as we call them sometimes?
A JAG. One of the things we learned, I mean, when I said we did not have any business background, we really didn't, and but we kept learning as we went along.
Yeah.
And one of the important things that we learned was, don't be head guide.
And interesting.
Yes, we are owners of the company, and yes, we are rowing, and yes, we're schlepping and doing that. But for the trip, there's going to be a head guide, and it's not going to be you. And the advantage of that is that the person who would be typically head guide doesn't get bumped and out of the position, mm-hmm. and is grumpy. Can maintain that status as head guide, mm-hmm. and you can see how the person's doing as a leader. Mm-hmm. Do they need to speak louder? Do they need to give their safety talk in a different way? Mm-hmm. Where if we were the head guides, we wouldn't be able to help that way.
Mm-hmm.
So
with running a team, what do you think your leadership style is?
Well, for us, it was very important to have the crew cooperate. I mean, that was sort of rule number one, of course, is safety. But yeah. Rule number two is this crew of four or five or six people, they better work together, and they better work together smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there's structure to the group. I mean, there were some companies that were so hang loose in the early days that they didn't even want to have a head guide. And it's sort of like you take forever to decide where you're going to stop for lunch.
Yeah.
Sort of like, no. So the idea was that you get along, you work together, you respect each other. You may have an ego, but don't let it get in the way of working with others. Mm-hmm. And so we really stress that of this is a team effort, and if you can't be a member of a team, then you should work for somebody else.
When the conflicts did arise, what would you do? Would you step in, or would you let them sort it out themselves?
Both. We'd start with them trying to sort it out themselves.
Yeah.
And for example, if let's just say there'd be some sort of rubs in some way. The classic example that's given is there's more than one way to cut a carrot. And some guides were just so intense on you cut the carrot this way.
Uh-huh.
And you cut it, and another person, you cut it that way. It sounds stupid, but I would see guides get in an argument over a carrot.
Yeah.
How to cut the carrot.
Yeah.
And then we'd have to kind of point out to them, well, there's more than one way to cut a carrot, and it's not mm-hmm. awful if it's cut differently from the way you have done it. And so you work on it and you, because you're with a group, and this is what was really good for Dick and me, was that you're working with an age group that's in their early 20s, mid 20s, and they're going to be moving on to positions of responsibility. I mean, they're not going to guide forever.
Yeah.
Because most guides, I'd say most men were probably 7-8 years, maybe more, mm-hmm. working with us, and women maybe 5-6 years with us. And mm-hmm. we knew that they're going to have permanent jobs someplace else. It's not going to be, they're not going to live off the season.
Right.
And so we would watch for people who demonstrated some type, when we had the interviews for people, we'd say, you know, ask them this question, ask them that question. And then what we were looking for was people who could lead, who could have a sense of humor, who had interesting backgrounds themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you wanted to not have a cookie cutter kind of guide. You wanted to have individuals, but you wanted them to be able to cooperate. And mm-hmm. So, for example, the phrase I use is, you want a personality that can make the sun shine on a rainy day.
I love that.
If you're out there and you're with 25 people and it's raining and they've just paid for their vacation.
Yeah.
You as a guide have got to make them smile, make them happy. Mm. And so it takes a certain personality to do that.
Yeah.
And so we would we know many, many of the guides that have, we have a strong ECHO alumni, former guides mm-hmm. who've gone on to medicine, teaching, Silicon Valley. The list just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Of the talent pool that we grabbed. But it was good helping them through those 20s to go yeah. from, they, you know, most of the time they've just graduated from school and they're 22, 3, 4 years old. And they have to learn to be, have fun, but first do it safely, have mm-hmm. fun, be in charge of equipment. And I mean, we imagine this, you're giving somebody 25 years old, you're giving them the company credit card, you're giving them the truck, you're giving them five other people to be responsible for, other crew members.
Uh-huh.
And we're saying, go to Idaho and we'll see you in 2 months. and they built on that. They go, well, he trusts me, and so yeah. I'm going to prove that I can be a head guide. I can run a safe trip. And so we had many years of people developing into what I call from young adult to full adult.
I'm just like, I'm reflecting on my own kind of guiding and how I feel like all of the people that I've worked with have done that for me, and how it really is so cool to learn so many transferable skills on the river. Yeah. I mean, yes. It's kind of mind blowing. And it's interesting too, because like my whole life I did golf and kickboxing, like the most random sports, and they're not team sports at really. No, they're so individual. And so looking back on my first year multi-day guiding, oh my gosh, I was a mess. Like I didn't know how to work on a team. And I remember just like crying in the kitchen being like, this is too much. I can't do it. I don't know how I'm going to do it. Like, oh no. And then looking at, you know, the third year and I'm trip leading most of the trips that I'm on and just how cool it is that that's where I learned teamwork.
Yeah. Somebody hands you three dozen boxes or three dozen eggs and said, okay, scramble them and have them ready in 10 minutes.
Well, I remember too, like talking about different ways to do a carrot, watching someone scramble eggs and be like, really, you're going to do it that way and be totally serious. And now I look back and I'm just like, oh, why did I say anything? But now I feel like I'm better at not saying anything. That's
one of the things
skill.
That kind of speaks well for guiding, even though it's not a lifetime career, is we would write, Dick and I would write letters of recommendation for people as they were getting ready to move on to mm-hmm. other things. And we would have employers call us or write back to us. Mostly they called and they would want to ask about the person. And they said, when I looked at the application, they said, we look at dozens of applications for this job. He said, mm-hmm. when I saw River Runner mm-hmm. as a part of it, he said, I take note. He said, because usually River Runners, they know how to talk to the public. Mm-hmm. They know how to deal with a truck breaking down. Mm-hmm. They know how to cook three dozen eggs. Mm-hmm.
They know how to back a trailer.
Exactly.
And
the employer would say, that's the kind of person I want. I want somebody who can deal with, you're always dealing with uncertainties in any job.
Yeah.
And we want somebody who can handle the uncertainties.
I also really think it's such a good career for, I mean, or whatever you want to call it, job for however long.
Yeah.
To be comfortable on water and to be able to find that escape near a river, I think is so special. When you go on a river trip now, like on a private trip, what's your favorite part of the routine of the day?
Letting everybody else do the work.
You just like kick up, pina colada in hand, sitting on the beach. You're like, okay, you should put that table over there.
It's way hang loose. It's way hang loose. I'm not involved in that way. It's pretty easy. Pretty easy approach. And again, I'm mostly retired, so I don't get out as much as I used to. But I think one of the things that I do miss about being on the river is that there's something magical about pushing off from shore, and the current grabs you, and you're off, and you're headed downstream, and any problems you have with the IRS or who knows what are they're way behind.
Gone.
You. They're gone.
Okay. Well, the catastrophizer in me just immediately thought, oh my gosh, okay, you push off from shore and you realize you've forgotten something. Have you ever forgotten stuff on a river trip? And if so, what's like the worst, most memorable thing you've forgotten?
Oh yeah. There's definitely been some messes. This did not, I can proudly say this did not happen to us.
Okay.
But this happened, okay. this happened to another river company, and I won't mention his name or the company's name.
Wise.
But they pushed off and they forgot the plates and silverware.
Oh no.
For the whole
trip. Oh no. Wait, how long was the trip?
5 days.
So, oh my gosh.
Yeah. So they, on day one, they scrambled to get something put together so they could serve dinner, because this is really obvious at lunch. At lunch, you can kind of fake it and mm-hmm. have sandwiches and so on. But by mm-hmm. dinner time, you need forks and knives and spoons and plates.
Yeah.
And that's when the reality hit. And so they kind of got through the first dinner, but they immediately went scrambling to see any other river companies going by, and they go, you know, we have a bit of a problem here. And so they borrowed enough from two or three other river companies that they got through the trip. But
and the other river companies are like, this is the best marketing we ever could have asked for. Our names are on these plates and these people are going to wish they were with us. Wow. So,
and there was a trip on the Stanislaus years ago at Mother Rapid where the raft didn't flip, but it took a pretty good beating, and uh-huh. all the stakes for the trip went to the bottom of the river. So this is a two-day trip
uh-huh.
and the big dinner and all that, and the stakes are on the bottom of the river. And on that one, the guides actually were diving down to retrieve the stakes.
Did they get them?
Oh yeah, yeah. They
oh,
had to. They
my had to. Gosh.
So
that is wild. Do you have a favorite camp meal?
Oh, I love lasagna.
Really?
It's fun to put together.
Uh huh.
It's fun to eat, and it's grand in scale. You know, big platter and all that. So
yeah, it's a showstopper.
It is. It is. Yeah. So,
with rafting and starting the company, running the company, you know, hiring all the personnel, dealing with conflict, when did you know, okay, I think I'm ready to retire?
Well, that hits you, gradually. But then there's a point when you know it really is time. And part of it has to do with, imagine an NBA basketball player who is great when they're 21 years old and 22 years old, but mm-hmm. then they're 39 years old. They know they don't run as fast. They mm-hmm. endurance isn't as much as good as it used to be. Same with mm-hmm. river running. There's a lot of work in terms of not so much on the river. It's the prepping, it's the camp mm-hmm. breakdown, setup, breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Those, somehow you can handle the river because you're dealing with the advantages of the currents.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, I realized I was getting older, I was getting tired, and the sun was really beating down on me.
Mm-hmm.
Guides refer to the sun as the oppressor.
Yeah, the great oppressor, we call it.
Yeah, the oppressor. The oppressor. I would look downstream, and sometimes I go, let's get this done before the oppressor shows up.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're fixing for example, the fire pan, you know, you have to mm-hmm. clean that off.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that, so it was pretty natural mm-hmm. that the time had come. And so it was in some ways it was hard, but it was realistic. I mean, you have to be realistic. So
I think it's really cool you were able to do it all with Dick at the same time, you know, that you two could bond over, okay, this is what's going on here, this is what's going on here, because you two retired at the same time, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It was an excellent partnership. And
Which is rare, I think.
I was just going to say, if you look around, at the river companies, most river companies are a solo person or a husband wife.
Yeah.
It's really unusual to have a partnership. And
yeah.
We had one for 43 years.
Amazing.
And I mean, Zach Collier definitely carried the pail of water there the last part of our career. But that was a good partnership too, in a way. It was a triangular relationship that worked well.
Yeah.
And I think by the time we got into maybe of our 43-year career, I'd say by the time we got to the 25th or 6th year, someplace in there, we became the longest running partnership in the country, in the nation. So
for rafting companies.
Yeah, for rafting companies. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you go to like all of the big outfitter things and stuff like that? I know there's like a convention and things like that. So you got to know all the other outfitters pretty well.
True. That's true.
Did you find that most outfitters had the same issues, you know, within their company, or was it pretty different?
There were common issues and they were different. For example, the Eastern outfitters heavily run one day trips. I mean, mm-hmm. tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
On a one day trip. And they own property. And so they developed their properties and they had a whole bunch of scale things mm-hmm. to deal with. Where Western outfitters, the property is owned by the federal government. The Park Service, the Forest Service, or Bureau of Land Management. Once in a while, there'd be a county or a city ownership, but for the most mm-hmm. part, it was federal. And so there was no land that you're going to own for put in or own for takeout. Mm-hmm. In the case of the American, there is, but that's the exception. And so you had to deal with the government in a different way than the Eastern outfitters dealt with. The Park Service and the Forest Service were the two in the East, mm-hmm. but they didn't have the same dominance that they'd have in the West.
Mm-hmm.
But there were other things that we had in common in terms of all the outfitters. We all were dealing with marketing.
Mm-hmm.
We were all dealing with safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's a piece of equipment that you would never use again?
Mm.
What's a piece of equipment that you absolutely want to have?
Wait, what were the answers to that?
Oh, it had to do with probably the quality of rafts.
Okay.
And there again, I probably shouldn't mention names.
Probably not. Well, what was the best quality? Let's shout out the best.
I liked Avon rafts from the UK, but
mm-hmm.
Now I don't know what, I mean, I've been out of touch enough now that I don't know what's really most current, but
yeah, that's fair.
But, yeah.
What about, what was the best safety gear that came about?
Well, believe it or not, this sounds so fundamental, but believe it or not, when I started, there was no such thing as a throw bag. It just didn't exist.
And, wild.
And I got into a bad situation on the river in Canada, in British Columbia, where the river was so fast that I couldn't get across the river. Where there were two of us, and one guy was 6'6" and 230 or something like that in size. He managed to barely get across the river. Then it was my turn. I'm not 6'6" and I don't weigh anything close to and so my first attempt didn't work out so well, and I realized that I had to turn it and go back to the river left.
Wow.
Because I was about to go over a waterfall that was filled with logs. It was a log-filled waterfall. And so I got back to the river left, and eventually, through some maneuvering of tying a rock around my stern line and throwing the rock over my head, and the guy catching the line on river right and pulled me in, because I was not going to make it.
Right.
I thought about that years later. It would have been so much easier if I'd had a throw bag. I mean, it would have been nothing. It wouldn't have been thought of.
Right.
So there's just so many improvements in rafting on every level. I mean, you think of the camp setting with fire pans now. I mean, we used to make fire pits at each camp, these big rocks, and put them
like dig them out.
Yeah, it was a and so and stupidly, each company wanted to have their own fire pit. So you come to a camp and there'd be three or four pits there from previous trips, and so like this is dumb, and so somebody invented the fire pit, and it's improved the quality of the beaches all over the place. I mean, you don't have, we call them scars. You don't have scars anymore.
Do you have a favorite river now?
It depends who I go with. If I have the crew that wants to go big, I probably go to the Tuolumne. Because a high water Tuolumne trip is just, it's blazing trails. I mean, it's beautiful, beautiful white water. It's ongoing. You go to the Gray's Grindstone, it's probably a third of a mile of rapids. It just go on and on and on. It's so wonderful.
Wild.
If I were going with brand new people who had no sense of what they're getting into, I probably would take them on the Rogue. It's a short enough trip. You can get there, have a good time, and not exhaust people. But if somebody said you've got one more trip in your life to do, I'd probably go do the Middle Fork.
Really?
Salmon. Yeah, Middle Fork of Salmon. And what I like about it is I like the high country, the alpine setting, the constant current, beautiful rapids. I mean, it's hard to beat.
I'm so excited.
The combination is hard to beat. Many rivers have one quality that the Middle Fork has. Middle Fork has multiple qualities.
I've only done the Middle Fork once, and I did it when I was like 17, and I don't remember any of it. But this year I'm going with my family, and I haven't done a family trip in 4 years. So I'm so excited.
You're doing
to
a
get
private
back
trip
there.
Or are you doing the company?
Yeah. No, private trip.
Yeah. Enjoy it. I mean,
I'm so excited.
It's a very special place.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
Do you have any trips planned for the summer?
We don't. As they get older, the emphasis turns to how relatives are doing with their health, babies being born, and they want to make sure that you see the new baby. The emphasis changes. I'm not objecting. I don't mind seeing new babies.
Like, trust me. I like them.
But it won't be river running this year. So
no. Okay. Well, it's going to be amazing.
In your case, you're going with more than one raft, I hope.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We're going to have, I don't know. I bet we'll have like at least six rafts, and then I'm going to kayak. There'll be two kayaks. Yeah. It's just going to be fun.
That's good. And it's just very, a very special place. And I hope you have a good time.
It's going to be lovely.
You're talking about kayaks. I was flashing to some of the funny things that happened in Echo over the years. And
let's hear it.
One of the rules we had was this involved kayak, inflatable kayaks, not the kayak. And the double inflatable kayaks. Our standing rule was no husbands and wives get in the same kayak.
Really? And was that enforced?
Absolutely. But what was interesting is we didn't really have to enforce it very much. The husbands and wives immediately agreed. Nobody said, oh no, I want to go with my husband or I want to go with my wife.
No way.
Because what we found over the years is that when they were husband and wife trying to take the kayak, they were trying to decide, okay, who's in charge here? And the person who is in charge, are they going to sit in? Are they going to sit in the front or are they going to be in the back? And so we're like, oh man. So we'd watch these people who started out on a vacation getting squabbles over who's going to be in charge, who's going to be in the front, who's going to be in the back, and who isn't. So we finally just said, no husbands and wives. Go meet a new person and go in the double kayak with a new friend. And nobody objected. They said,
what about parents with kids?
That was okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just no spouses.
No.
Wait, yeah, let's hear what are other things you remember from Echo that were just crazy or entertaining?
Oh, One, we had a very, we had a surprise.
Okay.
This was on the Rogue. And we had the group get to the first night's camp. And people are setting up their camp area. And this one person was down by the river, high up on a rock. And a magnificent, beautiful bald eagle starts flying upriver toward her. And it's maybe 100 feet off the water, maybe a little more. She starts singing God Bless America. And everybody dropped what they were doing. And when she finished, they go, "Who are you?" And it turned out she was a professional opera singer, Frederica Van Stad. And she didn't tell us her name. She used her husband's name to sign up for the trip. And so here's this moment, bald eagle upstream, beautiful, beautiful voice singing God Bless America. The people just applauded and dropped their jaw after she finished.
Did she finally then share that she was
right away.
She's like, okay, little secret. That's smart. Then she had like a total wow moment.
Wow. And we just had many, many good trips and wonderful people, a blending of guides and guests, friendships that developed after the trip.
I guess one question I have for you that I've kind of struggled with myself is, you know, you make a mistake on a trip or, you know, you kind of maybe didn't make the right call in a certain moment. How have you found the best way to like let it go?
Well, I think I read an article once about hot air balloon people, and I guess when you bring a pilot brings a hot air balloon down, you can do it gently or you can slam, boom, you hit the ground and sort of like it's chaotic. And this one veteran had a bad day, and when he as a the pilot of the hot air balloon brought it down, it slammed on the ground, and there's all sorts of commotion. And this one person says, "Well, are you upset? Are you upset?" He goes, "The sun is going to come up tomorrow. There'll be another day." And that he's sort of like, "Okay, I had a bad day, but I know there's going to be another. The sun's going to come up, and I'm going to be okay because I know who I am, and I can carry on." But I was going to add to that, when you said I've made a mistake, and let's say that either a head guide has made the wrong call, or a guide did not do the rapid correctly, or went down the wrong channel. We had another rule besides there's more than one way to cut a carrot. Another rule, and there's no way that husbands and wives are going to go together in the same kind. We had another rule, which was you praise a guide publicly, you criticize a guide privately, so that if there's you have something that you want to say that the guide has done well, you say it in front of the other guides. If your guide has done something that really kind of makes you cringe, you step aside and you step privately over to either the office or someplace else or downriver, and you talk about it, but you don't embarrass the guide in front of the other people. And these are things that you learn gradually, because I remember one of the first times we ever got a criticism. We had a guest come in and just it just wasn't right for that person, and so we called the guide immediately and we went rant to the guide, and then we realized that any story has more than one point of view, and when we talked to other guests on that trip, we talked to other guides on that trip, we realized that we were dealing with a cranky, obnoxious, overbearing guest. And that the guide really wasn't at fault. The guest was just obnoxious and overbearing individual. So our rule became there's more than one point of view on any issue, and we were not making any decisions until we talked to everybody. Or at least two other people.
Yeah, get all the point of views. That's really interesting.
But there was no textbook that taught you that one. You had to go through the experience.
Right. It sounds like you, I mean, I'm so impressed that you dove in head first and literally just figured it out.
We did. I mean, that's when I look back, that is surprising. I mean, here we are, two high school teachers.
Yeah.
Starting a business, no business background, but we knew we loved rivers. We knew that it was a great age group to be with. Mm-hmm. And the time was right. And we just were lucky to do what we did.
I also think it's so cool that you said, you know, you were able to mentor or teach or be involved with the growth of so many amazing people. And even just thinking like all the things that Zach has done for me and, you know, even this, you know, having the opportunity to do this and get to know so many more amazing people. It really is such a cool thing to be involved with the people in their early 20s and just yep. really shape who they become. I think it's so special and it's so cool that you were able to do that for so many people.
You know, it's interesting when you say that. It's partly that we helped shape what they became, but it's also that they had time together. For example, if you're doing a long shuttle and there are five people and one's sitting there with his arms folded saying, I think I'm going to be a lawyer. And the other four look at him and say, why would you do that? And there'd be this kind of dialogue that would go on. And I mean, and others would say, that's the right thing to do for you. And, mm-hmm. and so they learned among themselves as well as learning from us.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also interesting the way that I've viewed guiding and, you know, especially multi-day guiding, right? And that's what I've done the most of. I mean, I did it for 3 years and I did day guiding for a year, but it becomes your whole life, your whole ecosystem. The guides that you're with are literally like the only people that you see for months on end. I mean, what a cool community. And I think, you know, stepping out of that is really kind of intimidating. And yet at the same time, I'm so grateful that I did all of that because now I have the basis to create that community again.
Right. Well,
so well,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah. It's cool. And I've also heard of like all of the Echo reunions and all that kind of stuff that happened. Are those still ongoing?
They're not now. And partly it became just as we aged mm-hmm. in the early days, the, mm-hmm. I hate to even say this, but the end of the river season Echo party in Marin uh-huh. County, in Marin County was notorious, maybe.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. I've heard some stories.
Yes, outrageously notorious party. They did what? That kind of thing.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So then we moved from doing that annually. So they became less outrageous.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to, when we finally got to a point where we were older, you'd have the 20 year reunion and then you'd mm-hmm. have the 25 year reunion. And, mm-hmm. and what was happening there is that guides were coming from the various states, from Idaho, Oregon, California, and they'd all get together. And that was more civil and fun to do, and mm-hmm. a lot of nostalgia, a lot of storytelling, mm-hmm. Lots sorts of pictures. They were fun to get together, but the early days
too notorious
to talk about.
do you have any projects that you're working on now? I know you mentioned a book before we did the show. What are you working on now?
Well, the book. We're finished. We just finished it. And when I say we, it's Dick Linford is a very good writer. When we say mm-hmm. we divided things up, I was sort of the numbers person and he was the word person. But on his private life in his retirement, he's written about his growing up in Wyoming, in New Mexico, in California.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stories are outrageous. I mean, it's 19 short stories.
Uh-huh.
To give you one example, he had three buddies. So the four of them were in high school together. Three out of the four shot themselves in the foot or leg doing fast draw over a number of years. And this guy was saying, I'm going to draw faster than you. So three out of the four of them shot themselves trying to pretend as kids they were going to do fast draw. It was really stupid.
Was Dick one of the ones that shot himself in the foot?
He was lucky enough. He was the number one who didn't.
Okay.
The other three, one one got shot in the thigh, one got shot in the foot, two got shot in the foot.
Oh my gosh.
One bullet went between the toes, so the guy was really lucky. Didn't break any bones.
Jeez.
But, you know, so I tell people, I don't know how Dick made it through his teenage years alive. but it's a good book, and it was fun working on it. I mean, yeah. Dick wrote the stories, but then we had two Echo guides who were professors. One was in Colby College in Maine, uh-huh. and one was in Sacramento. Uh-huh. And so they and I got together and we looked at his stories and we said, you know, there could be a book here. And it would make Dick happy to have his collection of short stories.
Mm.
So he'd written 20 over the years, he'd written 25 short stories about his life.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a couple of them little dicey. So we said that probably won't work. we selected 19, 18 are true stories and one is fiction.
Uh-huh.
And it just got published. It's called Stories of a Western Wildhood.
Stories of a Western Wildhood.
By
Dick Linford. Where can we find it? Where can we buy it?
You can go www.
Okay. Where you write this at? www.westernwildhood WILDHOOD
.com.
Okay, I'm gonna put that in the comments. Let's see if it works. Okay, perfect. And show it. www.westernwildhood.com. Okay, and that's where you can find the book.
Yeah, can you tap on it? And a picture should come up.
That's above my technological pay grade. I'm not very. I'm decent at technology, but I'm not as good as I once was. Well, as I could be. But people will be able to find it from there. Well,
yeah, yes. So you've got a good summer set up for yourself. Are you doing other trips beyond the Middle Fork?
I have kind of set up a home base in White Salmon. So I'm working at a restaurant in town and hopefully I'll get up and do some other rivers or maybe go down and do a rogue trip. But I'm for now just kind of setting up a life, which is weird.
Well, no, I don't know how old you are, but it happens. There's an evolution you go through. And we used to refer to living out of a dry bag. And women get tired of living out of a dry bag faster than men do. But
yeah.
even the men finally hit the wall and realize yeah. you got to have an apartment, you got to have a house, you got to do more than live out of a dry bag.
Yeah, it's weird. I sold my van. Well, actually, I gave up. I recycled my van because it was too stressful to try and sell it. Because I, again, technologically challenged. I bought a truck, and yeah, I don't know. It's I hope to guide like guest guide. That's kind of yeah. the goal, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good standard. I think that's a good talking about trying to balance out one's life.
Yeah,
I think you'll have your sort of job in White Salmon.
Yeah,
you'll do some river days. It'll be okay. It'll be okay.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, thanks.
And surprises will come. I mean, that's part of it is there's serendipity out there, and serendipity shows up in surprising ways, of course.
What
serendipity is.
In your life, what's been like the best surprise that when you think of that moment, like of a surprise or serendipity?
Well, there probably are two. One, having the partnership with Dick Linford. I mean, that in so many ways that shouldn't have happened. I mean, I could have been teaching in another school. We could, the rooms could, the classrooms could not have, maybe they were different parts of the building, who knows what.
Yeah.
So having that compatibility was pretty amazing. And the second would be meeting my wife. We met in not so romantic setting. It was serendipitous in that the principal of this high school that Dick and I were teaching in, he comes into the teacher's room and he goes, "Hey, Linford, hey, Daly, you two guys live in Berkeley, right?" I go, "Yeah, yes, sir." He goes, "I've just hired a new teacher. I'll pick her up on the corner of Telegraph and Ward." "Yes, sir." And And so Monday morning at 8 o'clock or whenever it was, standing on the corner of Ward and Telegraph was Sue Daly. And we've now been married 53 years.
Wow. And did you know from that minute you saw her on the corner, or how did you know?
Oh, no, that's the funny part.
Okay, let's hear it.
She drove us crazy.
What?
Because Dick is not a morning person. So the coffee cup sits on the dash.
Uh-huh.
Dick drives.
Uh-huh.
I'm in the shotgun seat reading the sports page because that has to be read. In the back seat is this new person.
Uh-huh.
Yak, 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 yak.
Oh, yeah.
What about the department chairman? What about the principal? What about the English department? What about the art department? Blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
We were like, who is this person? And then a few weeks later, it hit.
How did you give her a ride the whole school year?
Yes.
Okay.
But one of the telling things was Earth Day. Earth Day happened for the first time in 1970.
Uh-huh.
And so that just got announced. Well, in 71, she got hired. So Dick and I said, okay, we're gonna man it out and demonstrate to the students. We're gonna ride the 20 miles on our bicycles from Berkeley to San Leandro where we were teaching.
Uh-huh.
And so we announced to Sue at that point, you're on your own for that day because Dick and I are taking our bicycles to San Leandro, and we hope you can find a ride to school.
Uh-huh.
Maybe a week later, she announces to the two of us that she's going to join us.
Yes.
And we're going like, oh, man, no.
Like, this is our day, Sue.
Little did we know. And so Dick and I secretly agreed that one would go in the front, one would go in the back, and we'd push her along.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, she kicked your butts, didn't she?
Well, what she did was that she she practiced the week before. She secretly on the weekend, she did it in 55 minutes on uh-huh. the weekend before. The day of, we did it in 60 minutes. It took us longer.
Oh my gosh.
I was totally impressed by the fact that she pulled that off so beautifully.
Oh my gosh. So you met at that school year, and then when did you get married?
Within 11 months.
Joe. That is wild.
Yeah. And so
and 53 years later.
53 years later. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, that's really, I think that just goes to show that in life, it really is all about the relationships that you make, because both of your surprises were like the two most important relationships in your life.
True.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's really cool to hear.
I feel I'm knocking on wood right now because I'm in good health and.
I'll knock it too.
Yeah. And I'm with friends and I feel very fortunate. When I look around at my peers in my age, a lot of them aren't as healthy as I am, and I feel lucky that way. So we're in a good spot.
That's really awesome. Wow.
And I wish you well, and things will sort out for you. Maybe there'll be a serendipitous moment, but maybe
there will be.
But maybe it'll be gradual too. You'll see.
Yeah.
But I'd say you're off to a good start with what you just described.
Thanks, Joe. Wow. Yeah. I'm like touched by everything you've said. This has been, you're just delightful. There's no other way to put it. So.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for sharing all the stories and knowledge. And I don't know, your life is awesome and you are amazing. So thanks so much for being on the show.
Enjoyed it. Take care.
All right. You too.